You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living.
So today we're talking with Brandon Scott Quittam. Is that how it goes?
That's right, Quittam.
Quittam, yeah. And you've got a diverse background. So I guess lately you're well known for an article that's out there, Bitcoin is a Decentralized Organism, Mycelium. And it's just part one of three. So we're all looking forward to the next two parts. And you're also a co-founder at the Yoga Nomads and a former ERP former ERP software sales engineer at Oracle?
Yeah, that's right. I sold enterprise software for Oracle for about 4 years right after college there.
That's amazing. So, yeah, let's get a little background on you. I definitely want to talk about this article and your ideas, but how did you become a sales engineer for Oracle, then a co-founder at Yoga Nomads, and now you're writing about Bitcoin as mycelium? I mean, I love this unique path. This is good. How'd you get there?
I understand from the outside looking in how none of that really makes sense. And I think that's pretty indicative of who I am. I just sort of follow my nose and I jump down little rabbit holes. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that not on my public facing profile that sort of fits into this story. So let's see if we can break this down. I grew up in Minnesota, typical high school student, I would say, big into sports. Went to college at the University of Minnesota. And from that point on, I started selling knives, which is kind of a strange story, through a company called Cutco. And I'm sure many people listening, or at least some people, have heard of these. I finished college running the school newspaper in Minnesota, again, sort of strange. And after college, I got a job at Oracle, actually as an ERP sales rep, not an engineer, just a sales guy there. And so I had a surface level understanding of the technology more as it relates to the business functions. And that's what I thought I wanted to do my whole life. I've always been entrepreneurial, starting strange little businesses growing up. And after about 3 years into my time at Oracle there, I realized that I had everything I wanted. I was getting recognized. I was the youngest person there, making money. You know, everything seemed to be going right on the outside, but I was not happy on the inside. And, you know, I wouldn't say this was some crippling depression or something. It was more just I show up to work and just really didn't feel fulfilled with what I was doing. And at that same time, I was being groomed for a promotion in the sales org. And I went to Denver, Colorado, spent a weekend with the new team. And I left that experience realizing that, okay, this is one option. If I continue this path, I'm going to become these people. And I really did not want to become those people. Deeply unhappy, problems with alcohol, unfaithful to their spouse, all these type of things. And so I decided to push pause on that promotion. And I did a yoga teacher training. And I did this at the same time as I was still working at Oracle. And I had a nice juxtaposition between the sales guys and girls and the yoga people. Very different. And, you know, I'd leave the yoga community happy, inspired, fulfilled, all these type of things. And then I would, you know, go to the sales organization and leave that meeting stressed and, you know, competitive and rigid and all these things. And so that sort of gave me the confidence through that experience to realize that, okay, maybe I don't have to be the big business guy that I thought my whole life was leading up to. And so my girlfriend at the time, now fiance, and I decided to quit our corporate jobs. We met at Oracle, by the way, and we quit our corporate jobs and bought a one-way ticket to India. And this was 2014, and that's when we started the Yoga Nomads, which is a website helping yoga teachers and other wellness entrepreneurs build a successful business. And that sort of started, we noticed a lot of yoga teachers that were professionals, their classes are filled, by all metrics they're successful, and yet they weren't making enough money to actually survive. And so we wanted to combine our business skills with our understanding of the yoga world and provide tools to help those people build successful businesses. And that's been both of our main source of income for the last 4 years or so. And this last year, we hired a rock star team, shout out to the team, that runs most of the day-to-day there. So I manage people and process and some of the strategic direction of that business. But essentially what I'm doing is I'm sort of buying my time back by hiring people so that I can go all in on crypto and more specifically Bitcoin. And that sort of brings us up to today. I would say the last year I fell in the rabbit hole deep, as they say, you know, in the beginning, 20-hour week studying Andreas Antonopoulos as my alarm clock and putting me to sleep at night kind of thing. Yeah, and somewhere in the middle, I could have mentioned I got very interested in fungi, foraging, cooking, everything to do with mushrooms and mycelium. And, you know, sort of hit me last year in Bali, meeting with some friends there, talking about Bitcoin, talking about mushrooms and seeing the parallels. And maybe you know this, a lot of listeners probably know this, but Bitcoin is a very complicated thing, but on the surface, it looks simple. And so right now, there's a lot of parallels in the crypto community where they're describing blockchain and mushrooms and Bitcoin and all these different things as organisms because they're so complicated. And once I made those connections and started seeing other people writing about Bitcoin as some sort of comparison to the natural world, like specifically Dan Held, his Planting Bitcoin series is very nice. That gave me the confidence to just go all in on this this comparison with mycelium. And I wasn't quite sure how the Bitcoin community, which can be very, very libertarian and finance driven, et cetera, I wasn't sure how they would respond to such a wacky analogy. But judging by the response in the last week or two, I'm really happy to say that the community likes the analogy.
Well, the community, of course, it's big and it spans all different, you know, types of people. I mean, everybody's into cryptocurrency. Well, I should not say everyone is into cryptocurrency, but there's a few people from almost every walk of life that are into cryptocurrency. So, yeah, and your article is definitely getting around. I mean, I've seen it just about everywhere I hang out when it comes to crypto. Since that's what I'm doing for a living these days, I see your article now, which is great that it's getting out there, because I think that a lot of the crypto community can be a bit eclectic, and seeing your article get traction reinforces that to me. Like another YouTube personality, Crypto Love, we're going to have him back on the show soon. And he's a raw food, vegan, beer growing, crypto loving, finding himself out in the desert kind of character. I mean, and so it's getting traction. And in a way, you can almost say Bitcoin is a little spiritual in itself, especially when you really can make the parallels that you did between Bitcoin and mycelium. And it's funny, since you worked at Oracle, I mean, that's a database is not a blockchain, but you really got a great foundation to then understand, you know, blockchain after working with Oracle, the great database, basically.
For sure. Yeah, surprisingly, I guess on paper that makes sense, but I wouldn't really equate much of what I learned at Oracle to helping to understand the blockchain stuff and Bitcoin. However, I would say that it helps me understand how enterprises such as Oracle and IBM, et cetera, how they would approach looking at blockchain technology. And what I've seen so far is actually not that impressive. Especially the Hyperledger Foundation and things like this, at least from the outsider looking in, it just appears that these enterprise software companies are just selling the hopium of blockchain. And there hasn't really been any meaningful implementations in the enterprise space. And I'm not actually sure that a blockchain will work in that space. From my perspective, blockchains are useful in adversarial conditions. And what we're seeing in the enterprise space is they're creating more federated chains where, let's say, several companies in the same supply chain share data in a way that they can govern and manage. But to me, I'm not so interested in that side. I'm much more interested in the public the public blockchains like Bitcoin and Ethereum and a few others.
Yeah, XRP or Ripple is not necessarily too interesting to me. And then you've got IBM, Stellar, I believe, Lumens, which Stellar Lumens maybe has one of the coolest names in crypto, but still, it's connected to the beast. And the way I feel most of the companies that we're talking about, you know, see crypto ultimately is a buzzword and a way to make money. And I don't think they're really into anything that's truly decentralized. And if they are, you know, great, but somehow they'd want to own that decentralized entity. So, you know, Bitcoin and then anything that the large corporations are putting out as far as a blockchain, it's two different ideals that are creating it.
Absolutely agreed. Especially when you look at government, where they have the most to lose, central banks and nation states, I believe. And part of the tweet storm I put out for this article, I put a picture from Omar Little from The Wire. And if anyone has watched that TV show, it's one of my favorites. But he has a quote in there saying, "You come at the king and you best not miss." And, you know, I'm sort of taking a jab, a little tongue in cheek there. But what I mean is that these nation states and central banks, they face a paradoxical challenge here. And so what they want to do is attempt to destroy the competition, being Bitcoin. But if they attempt to destroy the competition, what they're going to do on accident is highlight the very need for Bitcoin in the first place, as in a non-sovereign money. And, you know, the longer they wait, which right now I don't think they think too much of Bitcoin. I think they're a little bit arrogant here. They don't really see the disruptive potential. And so the longer that they wait and leave Bitcoin to grow and become stronger, the harder it's going to be to kill Bitcoin in the future, which I don't really see as a possibility at this point.
Yeah, I mean, right now it seems like governments are, or let's say our government, like here in the U.S., is definitely trying to regulate it, and it definitely doesn't like the anonymity, the anonymous nature of Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies that are more, you know, tailored towards security. So, but I do feel that it's kind of like when a new technology arrives, let's say like the iPhone was suddenly here one day. There was really no battle against the iPhone or the smartphone in finding its prominence that it has today. And so it seems like when something's truly next, there's really no way to fight it. It just happens. Like the post office took a big hit because of email, but it couldn't really do anything about it. So it seems like cryptocurrency, when it comes to the centralization of money and also the centralization of power in governments, it's going to be like the iPhone that just runs over all of that, you know. But it seems like the government and banks are definitely, I feel like they're very conniving right now, and they're trying to find a way to stifle it, or at least control it, or at least destroy the anonymous nature of it. I mean, do you feel that cryptocurrency, and I believe sounds like you already do, but that it really is a peaceful revolution of sorts? And what do you think that it's up against right now? What are some of its, you know, biggest adversaries, you might say, if it really has any that can put up a fight?
Yeah, good question. And I've listened to a couple other of your episodes, and I think you bring up the peaceful revolution thing from time to time, and I like that. And I would say, in general, yes, Bitcoin and this entire space is a peaceful revolution, in the sense that you're not really trying to go head-to-head and compete with Visa or the U.S. dollar or whatever. It's more of a parallel economic system that's going to grow slowly over time. And it allows people the opportunity to just, say, opt out of their local currency. And for some places like the U.S., where we have a relatively strong currency, we haven't seen devastating hyperinflation like you do see in Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, Cyprus, Greece, etc. It gives those more developing countries that have a weaker economic policy or economic outcomes, it gives them a chance to opt out. So to me, I think that's absolutely amazing. And, you know, ultimately what this whole experiment could be is it just sort of pushes back on the central powers and says, hey, look at this currency. It's got a hard cap. You know, it's deflationary. And so a lot of people like this. So maybe you as a central bank need to tighten up your monetary policy to compete with this. And that's kind of where what I see this as. It's kind of a Cambrian explosion of monetary species that are going to explode here and compete against each other. And, you know, you can kind of look at this as the Bitcoin as the experiment that allows us to experiment with money. And what I mean by that is, you know, more or less money is controlled by the government today. And since we got off the gold standard, it's been that way. And what that leads us to is a situation where there is no competition. And so we don't really even know what features, what qualities of moneyness are the best. And now that we have Bitcoin pop up saying, here's what we think are the best. And Ethereum says, well, we should have the base layer that's programmable. Someone else says it should be private on the base layer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so through this competition, I don't know if it's Bitcoin or something else, but I'm heavily in the Bitcoin camp for a number of reasons. But one of these monies, likely Bitcoin, will change everything. And I think it's due to the competition of money. I think you had some other questions embedded there before I went on that rant.
Oh, no, actually, that's perfect. Yeah, it definitely brings up the question of what is money. And as people have gotten more and more people get into Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies in general, but, you know, Bitcoin being kind of the gold standard, the big one, it seems like people are, it's an evolution in the way that we're seeing money and thinking about money and also thinking about taxes and thinking about how money moves and governmental control, because I know it's opened my mind quite a lot. And so people that I know who are, you know, trading right now, trading daily to, you know, make a living doing crypto, or who are just invested in it for maybe a HODL, a longer term investment, or who are just studying it to figure out what is this, one of the first things that comes up is taxes, you know? And it's funny, when you're just working on a W-2 form, and your money just basically a certain percent you just never get, even though you see what's being removed, somehow it's very easy to just miss that. You don't really think about it. But now a lot of people who do taxes are having to, accountants that do taxes are having to learn crypto. And it's creating a lot of these conversations between people and between people and accountants and such, saying, hey, wait a second, you know, how am I supposed to do business when I lose 40% of my profit? People start to become aware of it somehow when they start using crypto, where they never really did when they were just using regular fiat currency and a W-2 form, or maybe even like an I-9 or whether they're entrepreneurial. It's funny. It's almost like we're programmed not to notice taxes with fiat money. But when you start looking at money a different way in crypto, you start going, hey, wait a second, you know, who am I? This is crazy.
Absolutely. That's a pretty funny point. And I think by design, right, I think a lot of the ways governments feed themselves is on the backs of their constituents. And this could be directly through things like taxation. And then it could also be through things that are a little bit more obfuscated, like printing more money. In other words, increasing the monetary supply, which is just a subtle tax, an invisible tax on our savings accounts. And so I think what we're seeing right now globally with this massive amount of debt and more or less a populist revolution popping up in every country fighting back against these central authorities, what I hope we're going to see is the same thing we're seeing with money now, and that's competition. I hope we can see micro nation states, whether that's through seasteading, little floating islands with their own rules, or actual land masses given up by current nation states, in allowing these new forms of government to pop up, these experiments, really, whether it's a anarcho-capitalist, voluntarist vision, or any other type of vision. But I would love to see some experimentation with this. I don't think many people like paying taxes. And, you know, I think we could get a lot more done with less if we're not fighting wars and lining the pocketbooks of the people who lobby, et cetera. And so I'm very much of the ideal written out in The Sovereign Individual. which is a nice book, very held very closely by many crypto people. But it's essentially predicting looking at the world in 500-year megatrends, and mostly as a lever. The main lever that they use is violence, and so governments essentially have a monopoly on violence, which is what we pay with our taxes. They protect us, etc. And I would like to see a future where a whole bunch of microstates pop up, and that's also predicted in the book.
Okay, and that was the sovereign individual mastering the transition to the information age, I think. That was the book.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Written back in 1999. I'll have to check that one out. Well, definitely, yeah, like you mentioned, the monopoly of violence there. I mean, really, I would be for, like, when it comes to the experiment, and that seems like where cryptocurrency definitely is a part of the, if there's an evolution to humanity, if there's a spiritual, physical, intellectual evolution, then definitely cryptocurrency is something that we've created to help us evolve in that way. And when you mention, you know, governments and the monopoly of power, to me, I would be a lot more into any government that didn't have a monopoly of power, that basically couldn't use force. Okay, you can be an administrative assistant sitting out front and you can take care of things for us, but guess what? You have no power, you have no ability to use force. That, to me, that is an experiment I would love to see. Guess what? You don't have cops anymore and you don't have military. That's it. You know, you're the administrative assistant. You don't run the show anymore. Although a lot of administrative assistants do tend to run the office, but still, they don't have machine guns. You know, it's good.
Right. The one question, I generally like the ideals that you're displaying there. However, my only concern is protecting property rights. And I haven't really thought this through, but there needs to be a way to protect property rights. There's been a lot of studies indicating that making sure that property rights are tightly controlled, in other words, humans can collect property without them, the risk of them being stolen, is an important building block of society. And so if we could somehow incorporate that along with a government that is not violent, sign me up.
No, I hear you. I do hear you. I mean, you know, property rights, owning property and being able to say this is mine and being able to, well, live in it and also develop, you know, a business on it or, you know, public utilities, etc. It is rather essential. And that is something I have seen in, when I was a youngster, I was in the military and spent several months in Somalia. And one of the things that I saw there when a society literally collapsed overnight is that the bandits come and they kick everyone out of their neighborhoods. You know, it's, you really get into this sort of feudalistic system, you know, and without maybe an organization that could use force in place that says that, yes, this person's house does belong to them and you cannot take it from them, it does slow society down quite a lot. I saw the Somalis get over that, but really it wasn't until they had like a militia of the people that could protect property rights. It's one of the first things they did was protect property and then also protect commerce. Because if you can't, you know, fill up barrels of water and move them over to a community without somebody taking them from you, nothing really works. So yeah, you're right on with that for sure.
Fascinating story about Somalia.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one thing I think I'll have to write a book about that, just because it's like I saw a society that had everything become Stone Age very, very quickly. And then I saw it kind of reorganize itself and begin to, you know, function again. So a lot of times what all of the preppers, like this dystopian vision that they're envisioning, you know, I sometimes wonder, everybody's kind of doing it from a standpoint of conjecture. And I'm like, well, maybe I should use my experience and actually say, hey, look, here's at least in one case what did happen, you know. And it was not as apocalyptic as people would think, because humans tend to have a natural cooperative organizing, you know, principle to them. They do. In spite of what some might think, they do, you know. Just get rid of the governments and stuff. Well, anyway, so let's get into your article.
Sure.
So in your article here, and it is titled, Bitcoin is a Decentralized Organism, Mycelium, Part 1 of 3. And you start off with a great quote from Paul Stamets. from his book, I believe, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World, where he just mentions, I believe that mycelium is the neurological network of nature, interlacing mosaics of mycelium-infused habitats with information-sharing membranes. And I could read the rest of that, but people can just look it up and check it out. And I love that, though. I believe that mycelium is a neurological network of nature. And so you make the parallels that to some extent, you know, or to a very real extent, Bitcoin is just that. And your essay has three parts. So number one was, maybe we can just kind of expand on each one slightly. Bitcoin.
Sure.
So part one, Bitcoin as a decentralized network architecture, mycelium. So that connection between mycelium and Bitcoin, you expound upon it quite a lot in the article, but could you just, I guess, well, of course, for those listening, what did you mean? What do you see with that vision?
For sure. This is such a large topic and something I'm very passionate about. So if anyone listening finds this interesting, I encourage you to check out the actual article because we won't be able to quite do the full justice necessary. But yes, part one is Bitcoin as a decentralized network architecture. And that's essentially looking at the architecture of Bitcoin, which looks surprisingly similar to the architecture of mycelium. And before I forget, another nice parallel is the wood wide web instead of the world wide web for the mycelium. Thought that was kind of nice. but anyways, so Bitcoin is decentralized, meaning there are a whole bunch of different individual constituents that all play the same game, and the rules are enforced by the software that they run. And this is quite similar to how mycelium works. And for those who aren't familiar with mycelium, that is the main form of the organ, the kingdom fungi, which includes mushrooms. And there are more fungi than plants and animals combined. And humans are more closely related to fungi than they are to plants. And I say these things because a lot of people just sort of lump mushrooms into vegetables, which makes me sad. So fungi are fascinating. They're the building block organisms of our planet. And the mycelium that we're talking about here, which I compare to Bitcoin, is an underground one cell wall. You can think of it like a root structure. So think of the forest. Underground, there's this incredible web of roots that connect all the trees, all the plants. Everything's all connected through this mycelial medium. And this mycelium actually sends information bidirectionally, and it also sends resources like carbon, phosphorus, nitrogen, etc., and also little enzymes all throughout this network. And the mushroom actually brokers resources. So it goes down in the dirt and it mines for minerals. And then it brings these minerals up to a tree, and then the tree rewards the fungal network with sugars that the tree produced through photosynthesis. And so you've got this shared incentive mechanism for the fungi to improve the health of the entire forest. And it's also competing in a very, very competitive environment. And that competitive environment is essentially a microbiology militia underground, other bacteria, other fungi, all fighting for resources. And what the mycelium is incredibly capable at is finding a new competitor or a new food source. Let's say it's competing fungi. It says, oh no, we found something here. We better figure this out. It sends information to the mushroom scientists. The mushroom scientists, who are the best chemists in the world, they whip up some new molecular compound, which is perfectly tailored to fight that invader that they just found. They ship that information through the mycelium to the edges where it's needed, and now the mycelium can compete and defeat, ideally, this new competitor. The same thing works with a new food source. Paul Samets demonstrated that mycelium, oyster mushroom mycelium, can break the hydrocarbon bonds found in oil. So essentially inoculate a bunch of stinky rotten oil and throw some spores there from the oyster mushroom, cover it. 30 days later, the mushroom invented a way to eat oil, and the byproduct was oyster mushrooms. And there's absolutely no evidence of oil spill there anymore. Pretty cool. And now that we have a basic understanding of mycelium, let's try to make a few parallels with Bitcoin. And so
sounds good.
Let's see, how can we even start this now? Bitcoin is much more than just a money system. It's actually, like I said, an incentive structure with different constituents, whether they are developers, users, miners, exchanges, wallet creators. All these different people have a shared incentive to keep the ship going forward. And essentially, we're all tied together in a prisoner dilemma where we all have something at stake, so none of us want to break the system. And, you know, that's similar to fungi. And let's see. Another thing is fungi are antifragile. And what I mean by this is the fungi are attacked constantly. We go back to that example of the underground predator, and it creates a new enzyme to defeat that predator. And over time, all this incredible competition on the mycelium leads to the organism becoming stronger, because each attack, the mushroom learns what to do, produces an antidote, over time gets stronger. Bitcoin's the same way. So anytime someone attacks the network, or a bug is found, or something like that, the Bitcoin ecosystem responds. It sends information to the Bitcoin scientists, developers, who then create an enzyme, software patch, and then this software patch, this update, propagates throughout the system. And now that one enemy is defeated, and so if that same enemy came again, Bitcoin would be more prepared, and this continues over time, getting stronger and stronger. Another analogy Bitcoiners like is the honey badger. Honey badger is just sort of a rough and tough animal that picks on people bigger than itself. Yeah, I think this analogy could go forever.
It can, for sure. You know, also, we can kind of go into, that's like part one, then part two, you know, Bitcoin as a social phenomenon, mushrooms. I mean, those two together make me think about, in your article you wrote, there was an experiment. They basically laid out, I think, little pieces of oat, which is, let's see, this little article here that you wrote, it was, scientists conducted an experiment where an ancient fungus, slime mold, was incentivized to recreate the Tokyo subway system. Each subway stop node was marked with the slime mold's favorite food, oat flakes. After a short while, the slime mold grew to connect all the node stops in a more efficient design than the centrally planned committee of engineers hired by the Japanese government. And so it really is a Bitcoin, you could say, is a network that, you know, grows to connect whoever has a need for it or an interest in it.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating example, and it's also quite sobering to realize that a slime mold, who I have to clarify is technically not a fungus anymore. They changed that later. I'm not exactly sure what kingdom it's in. I think eukaryote. But point being, the fungi created a better rail system than our engineers. That's just mind-blowing. And so if that's true, then what else can nature do to help us in our design process, right? Nature already figured out all these challenges. It's got billions of years of trial and error, and only the strong systems survive till today, or the most adaptive systems. And so I, as a meta point here, I think we should turn to nature for our design, because it's significantly more efficient, more elegant, etc. And your other point there was how a decentralized network like fungi or Bitcoin can be, it sort of expands to the demand in which what it observes around it. And I think that's absolutely true. So, for example, in Bitcoin, let's say we see a bunch of states who wreck their money, their state money, like in Venezuela right now. And what happens is, okay, great. Bitcoin can now satisfy the store of value use case. And because there is a need in Venezuela, then Bitcoin is now incentivized to capture that need. In other words, people in the Bitcoin ecosystem help facilitate that unmet demand, which I think is absolutely fascinating. And another point here, which I think is really, really important and widely misunderstood, is looking at Bitcoin through its proof of work mechanism. And this is important because a lot of people say Bitcoin uses a lot of energy and that means that it's bad. And this argument is the lazy, tired, easy argument, but it's actually incredibly false. And so first you have to ask, Bitcoin uses a lot of energy, true. Compared to what? Right? Christmas lights use a lot of energy. Banks use a lot of energy. So it's not just a who uses energy a lot is bad kind of thing. It's what do you get for this energy? What is the value of this energy? And there was a study that recently came out. I think it was through CoinShares, their research team. But they found out that Bitcoin uses its energy consumption is actually 77% renewable. And the worldwide average is around 20%. And so from that metric alone, and I haven't fact-checked all the studies there, but that's about three or four times as efficient in terms of renewable energy as other use cases. And so just that alone makes Bitcoin very interesting and green relatively. And now there's another thing that Bitcoin does that's completely fascinating, and that's the fact that it actually unlocks stranded forms of energy, stranded energy assets, such as geothermal in the middle of nowhere. And so there's this property of energy where it doesn't travel over long distances very well. And so if you're producing energy, let's say in a rural place in Iceland, and you want to ship it to where the demand is near the cities, by the time you ship that energy however many miles to the city, you're left with very, very little energy that you created. The energy essentially dies on the vine. And so to use a historic example, what Iceland did was they noticed this. And what they ended up doing with all this excess energy that was essentially just wasted is they produced aluminum. And the process of producing aluminum is extremely energy intensive, otherwise quite cheap. And so what they did was they took their free input energy plus the ore needed, and they produced a whole bunch of aluminum in the middle of nowhere. And now this aluminum is a durable store of value, which actually does transport, unlike the energy. So they're turning wasted energy into an actual hard asset, which they can then sell. And it's in a sense, they're unlocking that stranded resource. And so now if we can use that same analogy in Bitcoin, what's happening is Bitcoin miners, which are very mobile, they just bring hardware, plug it in. So where these miners are actually going is to these stranded energy assets, assets that have too much supply and not enough demand reaching it, so energy is being wasted. Now, instead of wasting energy, you can plug in Bitcoin miners or sell it to miners, and now all this energy is being used to produce Bitcoins, which is a durable store of value, which can then be sold. So in effect, what we're seeing around the world is actually Bitcoin is subsidizing green energy projects. And this is going to push Bitcoin's energy consumption towards more and more renewable resources. And it's going to create an incentive model that will dramatically improve energy asset or renewable energy production on our planet. And so I have to take that time to hammer that point home, because I support the environment as much as the next guy, and I don't like being called an environment breaker or some silly thing because I support Bitcoin. Hopefully that all made sense.
Oh, it certainly does, because one question that often gets, you know, posed, that people ponder is, you know, what does one Bitcoin cost to mine? And of course, really the answer is it varies quite a lot depending on where you do it. And I think that, you know, some worry that, you know, Bitcoin could be mined where it's cheap, let's say by, you know, some bad guys or whatever, and then they could just hold on to it. But at the same time, you know, that argument doesn't really hold up, because if you hold on to it, then you don't really, you can't really use it. You don't have any value per se. So.
Sure. And there's another thing there, actually. The fact that, actually, you know what? Keep going.
Good. Yeah, actually, keep that in mind. Yeah, I know that's one of the people who sort of want to spread fear about Bitcoin right now will mention that, you know, it uses so much energy. And I would say that, like you were saying, it truly depends on how you look at it. And then, of course, you know, where the mining is happening, that makes a big difference and such. And also, as time progresses, once a Bitcoin is created, then it's kind of done. It's just being stored, and the moving of it isn't that big of a deal. So there is a lot of, you know, fear being put out there by, well, you see it all the time. You know, large financial institutions are always trying to scare us away from Bitcoin. But the energy thing, to me, it's kind of obviously a farce. Once you learn a little bit more about it, you realize, no, it's not using that much energy. I mean, just look at the energy it actually takes banks to move money in a traditional way. I mean, right. It's like, compare it to that. I mean, if you can get some hooks and things to measure there, you'd realize, well, sorry, you know, you using your, you know, debit card, your credit card to buy things really is using collectively way more power than it costs to move Bitcoin around. So,
absolutely. It's, and just, you can take this. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you could take this a step further and even say that fiat money produced by the government supports wars. And that's true because governments can fund wars and pay for those wars by printing new money, which effectively is stealing from their constituents. And so when you look at it like that, Bitcoin does not start wars, doesn't cause wars, because you can't print money. The money supply is hard. It's hard to produce. And, you know, some people probably aren't going to like that analogy, think I'm leaping too far, but throughout history, that is the case. Imagine if the government said, hey, do you want to go fight in the Middle East? And each person had to pay for it. They're like, okay, you're going to pay $2,000. Does everyone want to go to war? No one's going to vote for the war if they knew what the real cost of that war was. But instead, they hide it on the back end through inflation, inflating the monetary supply, that is.
Yeah, and that's one of the real powers of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general. Not that all cryptos are mined, but, you know, Bitcoin specifically, and many of them, governments can't print it. I mean, they can ultimately mine it, like the Chinese government does mine a lot of Bitcoin, from what I hear. I don't know if that's true. I haven't fact-checked it, but that's what a general consensus seems to be. But still, it costs money to mine it. You know, so ultimately, the fiat currency used to mine it then becomes something, a real store of value. And, you know, I find it interesting that that isn't noticed more. I mean, there's a lot of, fear that gets put out on the mainstream media through the, you know, from governments, from financial institutions about Bitcoin, but also you don't really see many, episodes on, how it helps to stop wars because you can't print it. You know, I mean, war is very easy to afford when a government can print money to fight it indefinitely, you know, and it's like where Bitcoin, it's like, sorry, there's only so much, you know, and I'm not giving you my Bitcoin to fight a war, and you can't have it, you know. So yeah, it's very true what you're saying.
And you know this probably more than most with your background in the military.
Oh yeah, well, I was definitely in the military before Bitcoin, but so I do hope that it, you know, does continue to be. I do have that dream of it being a peaceful revolution of sorts, because I mean, a lot of technology just, you know, happens. Like, there was a time where no one could imagine the whale oil economy failing. And most people don't even know that there was one now, but there was back in the day. That was the stuff, you know. And then, like, one day the cell phone comes along and it's, you know, now everybody is slightly transhuman. How'd that happen? So, got pros and cons. But I really think with cryptocurrency in general, it's just a peaceful revolution that when something is big enough and great enough, it's like they say, the old saying, you really can't beat an idea whose time has come, because it just happens. And the opposition to it just sort of, it almost gets so overwhelmed that it doesn't know what to even do about it. So I can only imagine the centralized financial institutions and the governments and such are kind of just becoming overwhelmed. They're like, how do we, you know, keep the control that we've always had? And it seems like really the way the peaceful revolution can happen is you just overwhelm them with speed. People just adopt it. So it does seem that almost the governments and the financial institutions, the banks, are sort of chasing the peaceful revolution, trying to keep up with it, trying to be a part of it. And that kind of leads me to, like, part three, Bitcoin has a catalyst for human evolution. you know? So how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, absolutely. And one quick add-on to what you were just mentioning, and then we'll get to that. And that's essentially what you're describing is the ethos of the cypherpunks, where Bitcoin was essentially birthed from. And I listened to a really cool presentation by Timothy May, one of the founders of the cypherpunks, who recently passed away. And in the presentation, he mentioned one of the core tenets of the cypherpunk movement, and that was do not ask for permission, just go build it. Cypherpunks write code. And you can see this example. Imagine if Satoshi asked the government, hey, I want to create a competitive money supply. Here's the deal. What do you think? Right? The government's obviously going to say no or tie him up in a legislative knot for several years, et cetera. Same thing could be said about Uber. Uber, in its infancy and still to a large extent today, operates in jurisdictions where it is illegal. And so if Uber would have just said, hey, and Lyft as well, hey, can I do this? The government would say no. Instead, they build it, they do it, they gain enough traction. And now the government says, well, it's already sort of there now. It's going to be a lot more work to get rid of it. And the exact same thing's happening with Bitcoin. It's just slowly creeping along, getting stronger and stronger. And by the time they realize, you know, how competitive it's going to be to their institutions, it might be too late, and that's my hope.
And I think Uber is a great example right there, because there was the taxi industry, which was abusive to its patrons, to put it lightly, that existed with an iron fist for quite a long time. I mean, it was oftentimes subsidized by cities, etc. In general, no one really enjoyed riding in a taxi. And when Uber happened, it was just over. The taxi industry, yeah, it still exists. I don't know to what extent it still exists, what, you know, percentage-wise, but, like, if you fly in and out of any major airport, you see the Uber lot. You, nobody wants to take the taxis. They're like, no, I don't. And there's, I would say mostly, the younger the people are, I think the more likely it is. But there are people now who don't own cars. They don't bother because they just Uber all over the place. You know, there's people who are delaying getting a license. I mean, like, they may never get a driver's license because they Uber. And it's funny, but that's that real peaceful revolution, you know? I mean, to put an industry out of business like the taxi industry without firing a shot, you know?
Absolutely. Good point there.
So keep going. Yes, let's get into part three. Bitcoin has a catalyst for human evolution.
Okay, and just a pause here as a meta side. The first article that's already out is comparing it to mycelium, and the second article, which I spent a lot of time writing today, compares Bitcoin to the mushroom, which is more of a social system and hints at the religious tendencies that come up both in the crypto space and as it relates to mushrooms. And now this third part, which will be published, you know, I'm guessing in a few weeks still, is looking way in the future, and that's looking at Bitcoin as the catalyst for human evolution. So let's dive into that. First, I want to give a shout out to Nick Szabo, who wrote an amazing article on his blog, Unenumerated, describing Bitcoin's real purpose, or blockchain's real purpose, as a mechanism to increase social scalability. And this is a really, really important concept for anyone who wants to understand the space and why the potential, why I feel like I can even make a claim like it's a catalyst for human evolution. And so to give a quick background on that, essentially human beings, there's a cap on how many people we can have in our tribe, in our social structure. And this was later named as Dunbar's number. And this essentially says that human beings can maintain social relationships, essentially care about your tribe, up to 150 people. Anything above that size, and all of a sudden the social hierarchy breaks down. You can't properly maintain more than that in terms of relationships. So in order to go above the Dunbar's number, we have to create institutions that provide more or less trust between different groups. So we're all from the same country, and I can think about that in my head, so I can trust you more than I can someone from, let's say, another country. or we all like the same sports team, part of the same religion, identify with the same hobbies, etc. So all of these are mental constructs that enable us to overcome Dunbar's number. And overcoming Dunbar's number is why Homo sapiens and not the Neanderthals or Homo erectus or the pygmies or any other hominids, why we took over the world and not these other species, even though for Neanderthals' case, they're stronger and smarter and have better tools than us. And so let's start with that foundation. And now we can go to fast forward to today, which I view as we're sort of hitting a ceiling again with our social scalability, just like the tribe did. So we're hitting a ceiling because we're essentially just in a nation state game. It's a game of chess where different nation states are fighting over resources. And this only ends one way, and that's with destruction. And if that happens, well, mushrooms will inherit the earth again, to bring it back to that, and they're not going to mind, right? The planet will keep going, but the human experiment will be over. And so why I think Bitcoin can help with this is think of Bitcoin as a trust machine. It's like an institution that lends trust, such as a bank would lend trust so two people can transact. However, Bitcoin allows people to make transactions from anywhere in the world, not knowing who each other are and not necessarily needing to trust each other. Instead, they trust the code works. And so if we can extrapolate that out into the future where anyone can trust anyone now across borders, now all of a sudden you can get what sort of starts to look like global cooperation. It can be fractured into hyperlocal different units, but we can leverage this trust machine to stop breaking our planet, to potentially assign cost to externalities, such as you fly a plane, you pay for oil, but no one pays for the cost of breaking the environment. And so, you know, a whole bunch of different things can come together through this trust machine. And that's essentially the foundation of this article. You've also got a little bit less meta concepts, such as Bitcoin drives us towards renewable energy, like we mentioned earlier. Paul Stamets has figured out a way to use fungi to stop varroa mites, which are the main cause of colony collapse in bees. And I don't know about you, but I like avocados and almonds and all the other foods that bees are responsible for. So, you know, mushrooms can do that as well. We could go on forever. Again, Bitcoin could stop wars or reduce them.
Oh, definitely. I mean, for one thing, Bitcoin is a store of value that is nationless. I mean, truly, in a way, that alone helps to, you know, create an environment of peace around the planet and as such, in some ways, because you're not really trading from country to country. You're not really having to go through governmental regulations, although they would like you to. You're not really dependent on banks to play by their rules. Somebody in any country or a business can trade with anyone else on the planet, really as if they were next door. So, you know, you could say that, you know, whether, you know, the Earth at this time being a borderless planet is a good thing or not. But definitely, I think with commerce, you know, Bitcoin is ultimately borderless commerce. Mm-hmm. And, well, something that you did write in your article, Life Without a Centralized Point of Failure, might be something to, you know, touch on as we're on the way out. Basically, I love your one line here. Anytime one attacks Bitcoin, mycelium, but doesn't successfully kill it, the system gets stronger. You know, and you mentioned that line from The Wire that Omar Little says, you know, if you come at the king, you best not miss. So it seems like the fight against Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies really is making it into a god. is making it stronger, you know, and truly maybe, you know, proving that store of value.
Absolutely. I think the point is important to make, but I think that we have to juxtapose it against who it's competing against, who Bitcoin's competing against. And I think the term by Taleb, anti-fragility, is kind of the point of that paragraph, where essentially a nation state has no competition. And so because it has no competition, it doesn't get any feedback from the environment or the market. So it sort of gets fragile and brittle, and it doesn't evolve with the market. And it only exists because of the force of the military keeping it in power in this example, which makes it fragile, right? Whereas opposed to Bitcoin, it's constantly being attacked, just like Mycelium Underground. So it's constantly having to reinvent itself and evolve and patch its errors and fix its code and harden its defenses and all these things. And that leads to Bitcoin becoming stronger over time. And eventually, I don't see how a nation state could kill it. You know, if they tried right now, there might be some ways to slow it down. But the cat's out of the bag. The genie's out of the bottle, however you'd like to say that.
Yeah, Pandora's box is open. And and then when a country does, let's say, try to regulate against it or outright ban it, well, it's kind of hard to do because the cunning person can still get their Bitcoin. So it's easier said than done, you know, and probably impossible really to, you know, for those who want to trade in Bitcoin or have Bitcoin. I mean, how do you really stop them? I mean, there's a million ways to do it. And
for sure.
Yeah. And also I like that there's many things we haven't talked about. We talked about, you know, Bitcoin explicitly. But of course, you know, cryptocurrencies and blockchain, which are kind of two different things, is another topic. And, you know, maybe there'll be a time in the future to get into that. But I would just suggest to people who maybe are not, who are listening to this, to the show, who aren't really into cryptos, there are so many different blockchain technologies coming out and cryptocurrencies coming out that exist. Like, for instance, VeChain, where... And I think there's another one called Foodcoin and such, where literally, for instance, you can, in a blockchain, kind of an immutable ledger, you can actually know, you can like scan the QR code on your wine if they use VeChain, and it will say, oh, look, you know, this is like the location, the coordinates that the grapes were grown, and this is like the chain that this is exactly how it got here. You know what I mean? So there's a lot more. When we're talking about Bitcoin, we're also talking about, of course, blockchain, and there's many cryptocurrencies. And all of this is, just so people know who are listening to this now and in the future, really, if you're not familiar with blockchain, with Bitcoin, check it out, because there's so much going on. It really is where the cool kids are hanging out. So as we tune out, and thank you so much for, you know, being on the show today, what are you working on right now? How can people get a hold of you? Where can they find your article? And of course, we'll link all these things in the show notes, but let's hear it from you before we go.
For sure. And I just want to say thanks, Craig. It was a honor talking with you. I had a lot of fun. You asked good questions, and I think we agree on a lot of stuff. So that's always cool to do. Where can people find me? I'm on Twitter. That's where I put out most of my thoughts about Bitcoin and the space. And my Twitter handle is bquittem, bquittem. So B and my last name. I'm on Medium, first name dot last name. So that's at Brandon Quittem. That's probably the main places where you can find the article and connect with me. My DMs are open in Twitter if you want to have this conversation. What am I working on? I'm trying to get out part two of this Bitcoin Mycelium series. The first one exploded, so I feel like I have a little pressure to make sure part two and part three are as good or better. So I'll be heads down on that. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, it's winter in Minnesota, and I'll be trying to just not die from the cold up here.
That's awesome. And it's winter here in Arizona, so we'll be trying to just, well, we'll happily not dying from the usual heat. And, I am off to make a pot of chaga in the crock pot, you know? And, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Craig.
Thank you. Talk to you later. Bye.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Radiant Creators. Check out more content at radiantcreators.com. If you like the show, give it a like. Share this. Comment. Keep the conversation going. You can also find us at alternatecurrentradio.com, where there's this show and a lot more.